Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rev Left Radio. We have a really fun episode for you today. We have on Everett Rummage from the podcast Age of Napoleon, and we have back on the show Arjun Handal from Deep Into History to talk about the recent Ridley Scott film Napoleon. We talk about the film, we offer our criticisms of the history depicted in the film, what we liked about the film, and then we zoom out and have a much broader conversation about French and European history, about the French Revolution, about Napoleon as both a figure and a betrayer of the revolution, or as he saw himself, the pinnacle of it. We talk about the Haitian Revolution and how Napoleon reintroduced slavery in the French colonies, but also on the other side, how he pushed against the rotting core of feudalism and monarchism throughout Europe and sort of dragged the rest of feudal and monarchical Europe by the hair into political modernity. So Napoleon is a fascinating character, and the history that swirls around him and that lifted him into the position that he got into is all fascinating as well. And we dive deep into it with two lovers of history that I couldn't ask for better collaborators on an episode like this. Also want to remind people that we have a relationship with our friends over at Kersplebladeb and Left Wing Books, that anybody who listens to Rev Left, you type in Rev Left at checkout and you can get any of their books 15% off. It's a really wonderful opportunity to bring down the price of some of these books and make it more affordable for Rev Left listeners. And the link that I'll provide in the show notes actually allows you to even bypass having to type anything in. You just click that link, pick your book, 15% off for Rev Left listeners. So shout out to Left Wing Books. Really appreciate the collaboration that we're doing with them and how they're allowing Rev Left listeners to get really interesting books of political left-wing history and theory at a cheaper price. So go check them out. But without further ado, here is my fascinating conversation with Everett and Arjun on the film, the man, the history, Napoleon.
My name is Everett Rummage. I'm the host of the Age of Napoleon podcast. And as far as I know, that's kind of the only thing of note I've ever done. So, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of Age of Napoleon. Love your work, so it's really cool to have you on the show. And then we have back on the show Arjun from Deep Into History. Arjun, how are you doing? And can you introduce yourself for people who might not know who you are?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm really excited to do this with two giants in the history space. This is going to be fun. I'm Arjun. I host the narrative flowing podcast, Deep Into History. I weave threads of history together into sagas so you can access that knowledge with the ease of remembering a favorite scene in a movie. I'm a tale spinner. I'm a lore master. And when you're armed with historical knowledge, it can no longer be used against you. Instead, you can wield it like a weapon, like a katana. Or perhaps let's just say like a cavalry saber today.
Wonderful. Cool. And if people have not already checked out Age of Napoleon or Deep Into History, highly, highly recommended. Of course, there'll be links in the show notes for anybody to easily find both of those shows and everything that they do. All right. Well, today we're going to be talking about the film Napoleon, as well as inevitably the history of the Napoleonic era, the Napoleonic Wars, the figure of Napoleon as a historical figure, etc. So we're going to kind of be weaving back and forth between, you know, our analysis of the film and our analysis of Napoleon as a historical figure. But I think first and foremost, I would like to start with this question for both of you. Why are you personally fascinated by the figure of Napoleon, and how did you come to get interested in him in the first place? Maybe Everett can start this one off.
For me, it's really been a lifelong thing. I mean, like, since I was a little kid. You know, at first, obviously, I mean, I think I first became aware of Napoleon when I was about, like, four. So, obviously, at first, I was not really, you know, delving into his broader historical significance. It was just, you know, his personal story I found interesting. But he's one of those people that, you know, kind of once you become aware of him and become interested in him, you know, if you are the type of person who's interested in history and politics, he just keeps popping up. And so kind of wherever over the years my interests have taken me, I've always, you know, found Napoleon there. And so that's what's kind of kept me interested in him all these years.
That's interesting. That's fascinating. You're right. He does pop up every time. Like, wherever you look these days, be it like a titan of industry or just a normal person, like, everyone brings up Napoleon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, he's kind of the, you know, the Napoleonic Wars to me are kind of the, you know, the crucible upon which the modern world was built. Mm-hmm. And so he is sort of in our DNA as modern people, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I've talked about Napoleon as dragging the rest of Europe by the hair into political modernity. And I think
that's great.
Yeah, we really have to understand the profound impact, whatever your analysis of him as an individual turns out to be. The historical impact is truly, you know, disproportionate to almost any other figure. I mean, you know, you look back at figures like Caesar or Alexander the Great, both figures of history that Napoleon self-consciously saw himself as in the sort of tradition of. They had these larger than life lives because of their impact on history. But Arjun, how did you originally get into Napoleon?
Well, like, I always kind of saw him as like a titanic figure that was demonized, particularly like in England, where I spent a lot of time as a child because of so much family there. So that kind of got me curious. It was a good way to like annoy my British cousins by like, you know, talking about how great Napoleon was. But, you know, what really got me into him, and this is kind of embarrassing, like I had no self-esteem as a young teen. Mm-hmm. And someone, I was trying to remember who, but it's probably a drunk aunt, told me to like read his love letters to Josephine if I wanted to learn how to talk to girls. So I had mixed results. I was too young to know the difference between like love and lust. However, like if you want like pure heat, I highly recommend his letters to his Polish mistress, Marie Walewska. Like, check this out. Okay. I saw no one but you. I admired no one but you. I want no one but you. And that's like his first letter to her. Mm-hmm. Like, that's gay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How about you, Brett?
Yeah, for me, it was kind of interesting because first and foremost, coming from a political direction, I get into the history of the French Revolution. I get into the history of the Paris Commune. We've done episodes on Rev Left of both of those topics. We even did a recent episode on Les Miserables, which is sort of this period of French history in between the French Revolution and the Paris Commune. So I've been interested in that era of French political history in particular. But it was really when I got a chance to go to Paris a few years ago, like an all-expenses-paid sort of situation, which was really cool, that I was very into the French Revolution, obviously, in the lead-up to that trip. But once you're in Paris, you see the marks of Napoleon everywhere. I took a little boat trip on the Seine River that runs through Paris, and you see these big, ornate N's on the bridges that you go under. And he just left his mark on the entirety of Paris. You can't experience Paris without, in part, experiencing the legacy of Napoleon. So although I was aware of Napoleon as this figure that emerged from the French Revolution, and I sort of have this marginal understanding of his importance historically, it was really, you know, being in Paris that set like my fascination with Napoleon off. And then ever since that trip, I had, you know, dived fairly deep into him, you know, hours and hours of biographies, listening to the Age of Napoleon podcast, among other things, to get a better understanding of him as a figure, and was absolutely fascinated by this figure, you know, as both this simultaneously the bayonet of the French Revolution and in some serious ways the betrayer of it. You know, and I just always, I found that incredibly fascinating and have ever since. So when I heard that this movie was coming out, I was very excited. I've always liked Joaquin Phoenix as an actor, and so I was really interested in it. And I think that might be a good segue into getting into the film itself. But before we get into the criticisms of the film, which I'm sure there are plenty, I would like to get both of your takes on what you sort of expected from the film, what were your hopes for it, and what are some of the things that you actually liked or appreciated about the film? And Everett, maybe you can go first.
I was hoping for so you guys might or might not be familiar with Ridley Scott's first movie, The Duelists.
Of course.
One of my absolute favorite movies, and is set during the Napoleonic Wars. So I was kind of hoping for something in that vein. You know, now that Scott's near the end of his career, you know, the idea maybe he'd be almost trying to bookend things by going back to the sort of the same style and tone as his first movie and the same era, obviously. It's really not what we got. It's a very strange movie in a lot of ways. I did enjoy the humor in it. That's something that I think is really missing from a lot of historical fiction. A lot of historical fiction, I think, is very sort of self-serious and really sort of obsessed with its own gravitas. And when you look at history up close, it's never like that. There's always an element of farce, especially around sort of great unprecedented events. And so I did enjoy the humor of it. I was not expecting that, but I did enjoy it. And I think that worked best in the sequences that dealt with the politics. You know, I think my favorite part of the movie was the depiction of the coup of 18 Brumaire, when Napoleon rose to power, which was a very, you know, almost farcical event at times. And I thought that the tone of the movie, that was almost kind of a madcap in a way, sort of fit with the actual atmosphere of the coup. So that would be the thing that the movie did the best. The depiction of Napoleon and Josephine's relationship was interesting and maybe sort of hinted at the reality, but, you know, obviously incomplete. But I would say that the strongest part of the movie is that coup sequence, because that is the part of Napoleon's biography that really matches up with the sort of odd, manic, over the top, humorous tone of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I generally agree with that. Yeah, I thought the. When you said interesting one to describe the depiction of Napoleon and Josephine, I was right on board with that because it was interesting indeed. Brett, well, what was your impression? I'll go after you.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first of all, I just have to say that with the Josephine stuff, I listened to Everett's episode with Chapo Trap House on the subject, and the hilarity of your discussion around the sex stuff was great. So we're probably not going to be able to get into that stuff on this episode, but if people want to hear some more details about like the real life, you know, sexual realities of Josephine and Napoleon, definitely go check it out, because that was featured in the film. You know, Napoleon as a sort of spastic and quick lover, you know, adding to the humor that Phoenix infused the character with. It was an interesting element, so people can definitely go check that out for more on that.
Do I need to warn you of my indiscretions?
No, madame.
Does where I have been concern you?
No, madame.
If you look down, you'll see a surprise. And once you see it, you will always want it.
But what I loved about the movie, and from the jump, I loved this part of it, was the pure spectacle, the costumes, right? The dress of the characters was on point, and just being immersed visually in revolutionary era of France is really cool, because, you know, you can look at documentaries and they'll have paintings and you know, you can get some visual idea of what things were like, but to have a huge budget bring that era of French political history to life and to visually be immersed in that spectacle was fascinating. And just as a film, you know, history aside, I thought it was an entrancing film. Like it didn't feel 2.5 hours. I was loving every second of it, being immersed in it. Of course, I noticed, and we'll get into this in a bit, the historical errors, and it was very clear from the beginning that Ridley Scott wasn't overly concerned with that aspect of it. I liked Phoenix as Napoleon. I had a lot of hopes for him. I like Phoenix playing weird characters. Obviously, the famous one is him playing the Joker, but also many years ago with Philip Seymour Hoffman, where he played the character in The Master. You know, very interesting, dynamic actor. So I was interested in how he would portray Napoleon. And before Arjun, before you go on with your take on this, I'm just interested really quick in Everett's take of Joaquin Phoenix as an actor playing Napoleon, since Everett, you have a really good grasp of Napoleon as a historical figure. What do you think about Phoenix's portrayal of Napoleon?
You know, no one is going to, in a 2.5 hour movie, sort of cover every facet of his character. So with that caveat, I did think it was a pretty good performance. He did capture, you know, Napoleon was this sort of introverted, eccentric guy in a lot of ways. You know, you look at how people viewed him before he was, you know, a powerful, famous, influential person. And he was seen as kind of an oddball and an outsider. There's a great description of him from someone who knew him in his early life that talks about him just kind of looking ramshackle and looking sort of, you know, he didn't take much care in his appearance, and he wasn't really into small talk, and he just was not an attractive figure, I guess you would say. And I thought that Phoenix did capture that, and did do a good job with the, you know, bringing that sort of, you know, he almost seems, when you read about him, he almost seems distracted quite often because he's just, you know, I think he's a person who lived a lot of his life in his own head. And I think that did come across in the performance. You know, that sort of introversion, intensity. You don't get very much of Napoleon's charisma from this movie. I think that's more a failing of the writing than it is of Phoenix's performance, though.
Yeah, Arjun.
Yeah, like I was, you know, I was hoping for something like very different, but like I did not expect it because, you know, it's Hollywood. But I'm excited anytime history is brought to the screen, especially like this way, which I thought was very grand. And like, you know, all of us, I'm sure, like long ago gave up on like historical accuracy in film. And I don't think it's fair to expect it, you know, when you're covering something as huge as Napoleon, like to condense it down into 2.5 hours is almost an impossible task. And, you know, I thought the acting, and I'm going to take exception with this, with you guys, like apart from Napoleon, was quite good. And like, I thought particularly like the depictions of like the horrors of like cannon and musket warfare was like portrayed really well. And overall, like it was quite a grand spectacle. I have to say that, like, I have to give credit for that for sure.
Yeah.
Grand spectacle is a good way to put it. I did, you know, you guys both mentioned that, and I should say, I agree with that it was engrossing and it was very fun to be immersed in that world.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I'll just like, okay, can we talk about the sex for a second? Because like, you know, we have Everett here, and Everett's an expert in Napoleon's sex life and sex. Yeah, Everett's like the. But yeah, okay, all right. Napoleon was like a very skilled lover, from everything I've ever read about him, right? Mm. And
yeah, I mean, that's the reputation, right?
Right, right. Like I'm referring to I think I either heard it on your show or maybe the Chapo episode. You said you once heard a debate between two BBC historians that whether or not he slept with 1,000 women, right?
Yes, they were. I once overheard two historians debating whether or not his body count was over 1,000, which is a lot. By all accounts, both Napoleon and Josephine were quite gifted in that department. So it was a little weird and disappointing to see their sex life as depicted as so dismal. Mm-hmm.
I think I can explain it, though. Okay, so Joaquin went deep into Batman lore to play the Joker, right? We can all agree on that. Like he goes deep and really gets into his characters. I think somehow in his research and, you know, researching all the films, I saw like Danny DeVito's Penguin fucking Josephine. that's my only like the only thing like that I didn't really like about it. But also I agree with what Everett said. Like I found none of the charisma that, you know, I think it developed with as he gained confidence in rank, particularly. I mean, we'll talk about the history, but like during like early in his rise, he had a way with people, and you know that didn't really come across because it seemed like, you know, he was kind of forced to be accepted just by merit of his military victories, when in fact, I think he was a rather charismatic person after his getting over his initial awkwardness.
Yeah, Everett, can you speak a little bit more
to
that?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's something that I think even professional historians sometimes underrate about him, is that he was, you know, as I mentioned, he was kind of an oddball, kind of an introvert, but he was really good at, you know, what we would call like retail politics. There's one little snippet in the movie where they sort of hint at this, that part during the invasion of Russia where he's kind of handing out bread to the soldiers and sort of kidding around with them.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
He was doing stuff like that all the time. A huge proportion of his soldiers had met him and had a chance to talk to him. And he was constantly just sort of getting involved with what, you know, the soldiers were doing. I've always enjoyed, there's a letter I found of his once where he went and visited his the camps of the army when they were waiting to invade Britain, which never actually happened, obviously. And he visited the camp and then wrote a letter back to the war ministry in Paris. And he's just listing all of the things that had been issued to the army and what kind of giving his rating on them. So like, you know, the tents are satisfactory. The hard biscuit is not good, needs to be replaced. The meat is good, you know? And so that's the level of involvement he has with kind of the soldiers' everyday lives.
Yeah, is
the movie, you don't get that. You know, I remember thinking at the end, you know, I watched the movie in this big crowded auditorium with people who know nothing about Napoleon. And at the end, when you see his soldiers rallying to him after his exile, it's like, you know, they must have been confused as to why that happened, because they never really show his relationship with the country or the army.
Right.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we'll get to it, but I think it comes down to the fact that, like, they didn't showcase the Italian campaign, like his first major command, because, like, I think we learn a lot about Napoleon just there, about, like, everything. And I think that's really where he grows. He matures into this kind of charismatic person, because there's, like, you know, positively, like, Marian, what the way, like, or like Caesar or Sulla, like, the way that he interacted with his troops, you know. And like,
that's exactly right.
Little corporal was like a term of endearment and respect, not an insult.
And I actually think if you were going to make a movie about Napoleon that was, you know, sort of aimed at getting to his essence, that campaign would be a really good vehicle for that. To just, you know, limit the scope of the movie to only be about that one campaign, I think that would do a really good job of showcasing his character, and, you know, not just sort of the comical and ridiculous side, but the the side that was able to conquer half the continent and leave quite a mark on the modern world.
I completely agree that, like, you know, if I could, obviously, and we'll get to this in a bit, but if I could make it a different film, I would have done exactly what you said, Everett, which is, like, sort of limit it to maybe a key military victory, and then explore his psychology and the depths of his, you know, personality in more in depth and less military history. Now, the military parts are obviously the spectacular parts of the film, and so they're fun and they're beautiful to watch. But, you know, it could have been done a little differently. But again, that's nitpicking. People are going to make movies how they make movies, and, you know, the critics are going to say what they have to say. But I did want to say that one of the things that's important about this, and my experience really cashed this out, and I think Everett even alluded to this a little bit, you got to have background knowledge of Napoleon walking into this film. If you're walking into this film trying to, you know, to learn about Napoleon, you're going to be utterly confused. If you don't have some basic background knowledge of the French Revolution, you know, you're going to be very confused. Who is this guy talking in the first scene? Well, it's Robespierre. You know, what do you know about him? And then, yeah, just like when he came back from exile and he quickly rallied his troops to his side, and they immediately, you know, embraced him and fell in line behind him. Yeah, you don't know that because the Phoenix character is like the sort of this goofball with no charisma. You can't imagine why he could just say a few words and immediately win over the hearts and minds of, you know, dozens or hundreds of troops. But if you know more about the background, you know that he was, as you both said, well-loved by his men, and he had a lot of charisma, particularly with them, in a lot of ways like Caesar had with his soldier. So I think that background knowledge going into the film was really crucial. My wife came with me. She's not particularly interested in this history, didn't know a lot about it. And afterwards, she sort of confirmed that, you know, it was fun to watch, but she was, you know, spent a lot of the movie sort of lost, not quite sure what was happening.
It's funny you should say that because, like, I noticed around me in the movie theater, apart from the couple behind me, where, like, they were fighting the whole time because the lady was very mad that she had to pay for the tickets, and the guy was like, well, I paid for your drink. So that was going on behind me, but everywhere else around me, I saw people constantly, like, looking at their phones, because it's a dark theater, you kind of see what they're looking at. They were looking at Wikipedia entries, explaining to whoever they went with what was happening. I think it was kind of fascinating because, like, half the audience knew the history and then half the audience didn't. And a lot of the movie was people explaining stuff back and forth.
Yeah, definitely. I actually got a wonderfully lucky in that it was just me and my wife in the entire theater. It was actually really cool. So I didn't get to see any reaction from fellow moviegoers, but we got the entire theater to ourselves to watch it in the middle of the day, a week or so after it came out. So I thought that was an interesting experience. But I found myself, you know, leaning over and explaining, you know, things, or my wife like tapping me and asking me like, what's going on here? And I was trying to fill in the blanks, but. Let's go ahead and get into the criticism. We've certainly launched a few criticisms already, but, you know, maybe we can go a little bit more in depth. What did the film get wrong, and what are your major critiques of the film, both as a film, perhaps, as well as an ostensible history?
Well, as far as just, you know, accuracy, you know, Arjun, I think you said very well at the beginning, you know, accuracy in historical fiction is kind of, you know, not the primary goal, and I think we should not judge creators of historical fiction for inaccuracies, you know, overly harshly, because it is, you know, they are not doing nonfiction, they are doing fiction. That said, there are, I mean, a huge number, I mean, almost every scene is not how it happened. I saw a clip from the BBC where they had some historian on being interviewed about this movie, and he said that there were only, out of the 2.5 hours, there were only 38 minutes that were accurate. And that struck me as maybe a bit charitable, actually. But to me, you know, again, that's not the most important thing. To me, the real criticism of this movie is sort of the void at the center of it, which is Napoleon himself. You know, I think that they don't really, I mean, this is probably the most impactful, you know, single individual of modern history. A guy who led an absolutely crazy life, who millions and millions of people followed, hundreds of thousands laid down their lives for. You don't get any sense of why, you know, why was he able to do all these things? Why was he popular? Why did people follow him? Why was he important? The movie does not seem to be interested in any of these questions. It's mostly about sort of the ridiculous side of his personality more than anything else, and sort of the dysfunction of his relationship. So, you know, I felt like there was a big part of the story missing. Maybe the director's cut will cure me of that. But that to me was the biggest criticism, more than the inaccuracies, some of which were slightly annoying. But I think, you know, again, this is a big budget Hollywood movie. I don't think we should be expecting accuracy in any sense that a, you know, historian would recognize.
Yeah, totally. I agree with you. I think, like, they, you know, there was no joie de vivre, if you will. You know, like, it was. Especially like when it came to Napoleon, it was a very kind of, I would say like a dark, brooding character, like almost like an introvert throughout you know, rather than showing like an evolution of his character, which I think is more true to history and I think would have been pretty easy to do. But I also thought, like, okay, so in the major battles, so like, and there were quite a few in this movie, I would have appreciated more like an aerial view that would have like allowed the viewer to kind of know what was actually happening. Like, I'm not a fan of like Oliver Stone's Alexander, but like he shot the Titanic Battle of Gaugamela and gave a sense of like what was happening on each side of the battle by like dividing it into wings through the aerial view. And I thought like that would have been a brilliant technique to employ here.
The battles, there's some really cool visuals in all the battle scenes, but they don't really give you much of a sense of how Napoleon won these battles.
Right.
You know, they sort of kind of crudely imply this trap at Austerlitz, but they don't really show you how that was achieved. And the other criticism I had of the battles, they sort of seem short and small scale.
Right.
And maybe that's just a challenge of trying to show so many of them in this short time frame. But, you know, Austerlitz, you know, from the version of Austerlitz we get in the movie, you would assume that, you know, it was like a few thousand people fighting for like, you know, maybe an hour and a half. When in fact, it was like, you know, well over 100,000 people who fought for the better part of a day. Some of these battles lasted several days, and you don't really get much of a sense of that from this movie.
Yeah.
Brett, well, how about you? What do you think?
Yeah, no,
about the battles.
I definitely agree with all that. And yeah, the battles, because the movie was focused on showing, you know, in spectacular form some of these battles and all of that, that you sometimes aren't informed on what, like sort of as Everett was saying, what makes Napoleon a military genius. You know, it's just like he's winning, but you're not exactly sure why he's winning so many. You don't get the full sense of just how desperate, I mean, you get this a little bit, but just how desperate the rest of Europe was to stop this madman. And then also his foray into Egypt is one of, in my personal opinion, one of the most interesting aspects of Napoleon's sort of military career. And of course, you know, it's like it shows that scene where they shoot off the top of the pyramid, which, you know, kind of just bothers me because we all see the pyramid. We know that the top is still on. And like the fact that, like, you know, the real battle happened some 20 miles away or whatever. Of course, these are just, you know, little things that are woven into the movie to sort of speed things up and make a point. And I think Ridley Scott even mentioned, like, I don't really care about the historical accuracy of the Egyptian campaign, and him blowing off the top of the pyramid was just sort of shorthand for like, he came, he saw, he conquered, blah, blah, blah. But you know, I would have liked a little bit more of that. There was that scene where Napoleon and his, you know, humor, Joaquin Phoenix's portrayal of him as this sort of humorous, buffoonish sort of character, sort of looking at the mummy and, you know, like getting face to face with the mummy, looking all weird. And the guys are standing behind him, sort of giving each other like weird glances, like, what is this guy doing? But, you know, of course, that is that's a big part of the story where he basically, or his campaign basically founds the field of Egyptology. I would have liked to, of course, seen a little bit more on that. If you just had a whole 2.5 hour movie about Napoleon in Egypt, that would have been pretty fascinating. Another thing that I would have really loved, and this is probably nitpicking, of course, it all is, but to get deeper into the psychology of Napoleon, you know, the sort of egoic grandeur of him seeing himself as a Caesarian figure, and then like playing out that reality where it just seems like, you know, fate really is on his side. The God of War really seems to walk beside him. Getting into that element of his psychology would have certainly been interesting. You know, that famous quote when he was in the Egyptian campaign where he says, "I saw myself founding a new religion, marching into Asia, riding an elephant, a turban on my head, and in my hand, the new Quran." This is like insane megalomania that he's going to do this.
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
I should point out that quotation, he's being self-deprecated.
Okay. Damn, I didn't know that.
It's a very commonly misunderstood quotation. You read the whole context, and he's reflecting back on the Egyptian campaign years later. Mm. And he is, you know, that's something people don't, I think, realize about Napoleon, is in private, all that egomania just kind of evaporated, and he was actually really self-deprecating to his close, you know, confidants, of which there were not many. But in that quotation, he's basically being sarcastic and saying, yeah, I had all these crazy dreams about what would happen when I got there, and none of it panned out because it was all so grandiose and the reality was a lot tougher than I'd imagined. And so that's what he's saying in that quote, is he's making fun of his own ambition.
Interesting.
Fascinating.
Which is not a side of Napoleon you really see in kind of the popular image of him.
Did you guys see the argument on Twitter that came out? Like, okay, so obviously it was about like shooting the top of the pyramid off. And then there was this whole other argument, you know, particularly among like the BBC historian crowd, that to your knowledge, did Napoleon's cannon blow off the Sphinx's nose? Is that true or is it false? Or is that British propaganda?
I've tried to wade too deeply into these sort of specific apocrypha, because there's so many
don't blame you.
Sort of unsourced stories about him. I've never read a good source that mentioned that, so I don't think that's true. But, I mean, you never know with this guy. I don't think that's true, in short, no.
Right, right. Just like to be a troll, I was just trolling that, like, you know, Napoleon discovered the Rosetta Stone, which is like the most prominent thing you'll probably see in the entire British Museum, which is vast. And I think that for like the sake of like Britain's own self-image, not that they're going to give back anything, but if they were to give back everything, they would always hold on to the Rosetta Stone, because like winning over Napoleon is so essential to Britain's self-image.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that was there was a big legal battle over that, because, like, technically speaking, the Rosetta Stone was actually stolen from a French officer. It came into the possession of a French officer during the expedition, and when the expedition at the very bitter end had to surrender to the British, but it was a conditional surrender, and one of the conditions was the British would allow the officers to keep all their possessions and would ship all their possessions back to France with them. And so the day comes, and this French officer is, you know, overseeing them loading this gigantic stone onto the ship. And some British officer comes out and is like, wait. Come on, that's not your personal possession. That thing's huge. We're not bringing that back to France for you. Come on. And the guy says, hey, it's in the treaty you people signed. If you didn't want to take my stuff back, you shouldn't have signed the treaty. And it became this this big controversy. And, you know, it got to the point where the diplomats of the two countries were fighting over it. So that was quite a hot potato in the early 19th century, the Rosetta Stone, between Britain and France. Of course, you know, Egypt's not a part of this conversation, unfortunately.
No, of course not. Egypt can never be involved. It had nothing to do with the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah. So I kind of wanted to talk about the legacy of Napoleon, particularly in the relationship between the British and the French. Sometimes people outside of Europe, you know, Americans who study this history don't know that this is still such a hot topic, such a controversial topic. You know, people in Britain sometimes see Napoleon as a sort of Hitlerian figure even. Can you speak a little bit to that legacy between Britain and France, and why Napoleon is such a figure of largely disdain, but in general fascination for the British still?
That was something that I was not fully prepared for when I started the show. You know, to me, you know, I'm very interested in this stuff, but to me, it doesn't really have the. I don't see it as having much sort of direct one-to-one resonance in the modern world. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, these questions of, you know, kind of who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, I mean, it's so far in the past, and they're, you know, I don't really find a lot of good guys on any side of this story. You know, to me, it's like, you know, reading about the Trojan War or something. It's just, you know, it's so far in the past. Who's thinking about it in those terms? Well, it turns out quite a lot of British people are thinking about it in those terms. I think there's sort of a narrative of British history that's out there that's, that depicts the British as sort of these perennial defenders of freedom in Europe, against Napoleon, against the Kaiser, against Hitler, against the Soviets. The British have always answered the call to sort of defend the rights of the small countries of the continent from these would-be dictators. And I just, it's not an entirely... And you can sort of see how people came to believe that, especially given all of the propaganda about Napoleon that was distributed in Britain during his lifetime. But that's just not really, I don't think that's a very fruitful lens to look at this stuff through, and certainly not a very interesting lens. You know, that's always something that surprises me. You know, there's these people who are sort of obsessed with the topic, who choose to look at it through this sort of reductive lens that kind of destroys nuance and just kind of flattens the story. And I kind of don't understand why you would obsess over something and then pick kind of the least interesting view of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And as far as I'm aware, France was never able to like invade Britain and commit atrocities or anything. So the fact that like average Brits would be still so worked up about it and so invested in making Napoleon this evil figure. I mean, I get that there's this long rivalry between the two countries and all these battles that took place before, during, and after the Napoleonic era. But am I correct? Like they never crossed the channel and invaded Britain, right?
No, I mean, there was a period of sort of invasion fever where it looked like they were about to. And so for actually several years, there was this sort of public panic in Britain, which I think is actually the origin of some of these attitudes. Mm-hmm. But they never were able to actually set foot on British soil. There was a sort of abortive diversionary invasion where they very briefly were able to put some troops in Wales. When there was a attempt to invade Ireland, but there was never any serious French invasion of the UK.
Right. So the preparations for that crossing, they're kind of akin to Operation Sea Lion that the Nazis were trying to do. Right. Like they were building up and up and up on the north coast of France, but the British Navy would. And the weather on the channel would make like a crossing like impossible, right?
Right. And you know, it's just amphibious warfare in that era is just so difficult. The British could barely pull it off, and they were the best in the world at it. So that was, I think, more than anything, Napoleon was hoping that sort of the threat of an invasion would affect the internal politics in the UK, which he was sort of half successful at. He was able to affect the internal politics of Britain, but in the opposite direction than what he was hoping. He was hoping that would encourage sort of pro-peace voices to come forward. But instead, what happened is people sort of got very afraid and rallied around the government, hoping the government would protect them from Napoleon.
Mm. Fascinating.
That is, yeah. So I have another part of the history and the film that, you know, the film depicted this event as well. There's a famous painting about it. And I've obviously, when I was in Paris, I stood outside Notre Dame. It was still being repaired from the fire several years ago. So people weren't allowed in. But this is the cathedral within which Napoleon crowned himself emperor. And of course, it doesn't go into the background of the history here, but my understanding is that 1,000-some years earlier, Charlemagne, was sort of being crowned king or whatever, and the Pope at that time put the crown on the head of Charlemagne. And what that symbolized was, although you have the rise of this powerful political sovereign, he ultimately derives his power or is in some way underneath the rule of the church. And so Napoleon, understanding that history, because Napoleon was a bit of a history nerd himself, understanding that history, refused to allow any other person to put the crown on his head. And so he insisted on, and sort of to the shock of the people attending, insisted on putting the crown on his own head, basically learning from the mistake of Charlemagne. And I was, and you know, of course, also calling himself emperor, not king. There are many kings throughout Europe at this time, and of course, the revolution that allowed Napoleon to rise in the first place came about by beheading their king. So Napoleon was not going to call himself a king of France or one king among many. He insisted on calling himself emperor, standing above even kings.
I found the crown of France in the gutter. I picked it up with the tip of my sword and cleaned it and placed it atop my own head.
And I thought that was an interesting portrayal, interesting history, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are, or if you could even deepen our understanding of that event.
So, as you mentioned, yes, this is there's the influence of Charlemagne. Charlemagne's a huge influence on the coronation ceremony, and so Napoleon was surely thinking of that precedent. But he, no one was shocked by him crowning himself. That was actually pre-planned and had always been a part of the ceremony. Mm. And part of that was actually meant to represent, you know, his own, the, you know, the fact that he had seized the crown through his own efforts, and that he was, you know, he did not view himself as subordinate to the Pope in any way. But part of it also was that the Pope was actually sort of on the fence about even being involved at all, because the conflict between France and the Vatican was only, had only been over for a few years and was still sort of, there was still a lot of hurt feelings. And so they actually had to sort of beg the Pope to even be involved. And actually, he kind of the compromise they settled on was that he would be there to sort of bless the event, but then he would leave before Napoleon crowned himself so that he wouldn't actually be associated with that specific moment of the ceremony. Mm. And part of his conditions for being involved in that, he demanded some territory from France, which France promised him and then reneged on. And he also demanded that Napoleon and Josephine get a proper Catholic wedding, which they had not done. As the movie depicts, they were married in a civil ceremony. And so actually the night before the coronation, they had to find a priest and bring him into the palace and they have him do a quickie wedding ceremony for Napoleon and Josephine, because otherwise the Pope would not be involved, because in the eyes of the church, Napoleon and Josephine were not even technically married. So they had to go through this weird sham ceremony the night before the coronation.
So interesting. Like, so do you guys think that, like, the act of him crowning himself, like Everett, you said that it was pre-planned. Do you think that was an effort to, obviously he kind of subverted, he did subvert the revolution, but do you think it was meant to display revolutionary ideals in the sense that, you know, his image, his propaganda, I'm a common man and I am crowning myself. I made myself emperor, therefore I'm the end result of the revolution.
Mm. So I think that's exactly right. You know, the coronation, to us, it looks like this kind of weird, stilted, almost medieval ceremony. But it actually, he did not follow the precedents of an old medieval style coronation. That whole ceremony was sort of new. And at the time, actually, people kind of found it weird because it was not a traditional coronation. It was not harkening back to the Middle Ages. It was sort of all invented tradition. A lot of stuff like some of the regalia was called, you know, like the scepter of Charlemagne, but you know, Charlemagne never touched it. It was new. It was sort of crafted to look old and sort of imply that it was related to Charlemagne, but it was all new invented tradition. So it is very much, you know, I read something interesting recently that talked about, you know, that famous Napoleon said, said the revolution is over when he took power. And this argued actually that that's maybe not the right translation, and that maybe we should be saying that Napoleon said the revolution is completed, meaning, you know, not that I'm rejecting it so much that, you know, it was a process and now the process is completed. And, you know, here is the product of that process, which is a fully reformed French monarchy that has incorporated all of the positive developments of the revolution. And so there is no more need for, you know, ongoing political dissension and turmoil because the process is over and, you know, now we can turn the page.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yo, I'm loving this, guys, because like I'm getting more from you two than I have. Like in preparing for this, I went back and read all my old books, and then I started listening to like, you know, lectures and podcasts and stuff. And like, yeah, man, like I just literally heard today some on one of the big, you know, interview podcasts where they said that the professor said that he was held the scepter of Charlemagne. And I was like, I was pretty sure that's fake, but no, we have proof. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I appreciate Everett correcting the record on several things. I would watch full documentaries, and some of the things that I said, like even that quote when he was in Egypt, was presented in several documentaries as not at all self-deprecating, as a genuine reflection of his growing, you know, megalomania or whatever. So it's really helpful to have those sorts of things criticized. There's so much apocryphal stuff when it comes to a figure like Napoleon. So much stuff seeps into the discourse. Mythologies are created around him. So, you know, this is one of those topics that can lend itself to various distortions. But I think this discussion leads well into this next question, which I think is really crucial to understanding. We're just talking about him seeing himself as the pinnacle of the revolution. In a lot of ways, people throughout France welcomed him becoming emperor as this symbol of now stability after many years of tumult. You know, you have the French Revolution, you have the Reign of Terror, you have the Thermidorian Reaction. It's a big period of instability for the French. And so, you know, in some sense, Napoleon sort of ends the revolution, wraps it up, betrays it in some ways. I mean, where's the Republic? It's gone. He's now the emperor. But in other ways, he carries forward the modernizing aspects of the French Revolution. So the question to both of you is, what is Napoleon's ultimate relationship to the French Revolution and its legacy? I would love to hear your thoughts on that connection.
Everett, you're the man. You go first, man.
Fair enough. Well, you know, like anything with Napoleon, you know, the answer is it's complicated. But to actually delve into the question, you know, in some ways, yes, he is, you know, the ultimate betrayer of the revolution. You know, he brought back, he cozied up to the Vatican. He brought back the aristocracy, you know, both literally in the sense of restoring the concept of nobility to France, and then also welcoming back the émigrés who had left the country during the revolution. You know, his coup was launched with a pretense of cracking down on the left before they could launch their own coup, which was not true. You know, his secret police were waging war on the left, and they waged war right back at him by trying to kill him and kidnap him repeatedly. So, you know, yeah, Napoleon in some ways is a reactionary figure. Well, maybe not fair to call him a reactionary figure, but at least a conservative figure. Mm-hmm. In some ways, he is a, you know, counter-revolutionary. But kind of if you look at his broader legacy, sort of what were the, you know, On the biggest possible level, you know, what was the macro impact of his career on humanity? As you say, it's basically he was an agent of the revolution, the ultimate agent of the revolution. He probably did more to spread the ideals of the revolution than Robespierre or Danton or any of the other, you know, great firebrand radicals of the really radical period of the revolution. Look at, and again, it's not, there's the side to him. It's kind of a strange paradox where the side of him that is most important is his most boring side. He was an absolute workaholic, and his administrative reforms and sort of philosophy of government and philosophy of society that he tried to inculcate wherever his influence spread was very modern and, for the time, progressive. And a big reason that those ideals became so important in the 19th century. So, you know, again, on a, you know, close read, you know, personal level, he's, you know, in some ways the destroyer of the revolution. But then you zoom out and you see, well, in other ways, he's the man who brought the revolution global. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a complicated relationship.
Brett, I have to give credit to my dear friend Brett. He said it best, and I've quoted him many times in the last 6 months after I heard it. He said that Napoleon launched a Republican jihad across Europe.
And I kind of think that sometimes myth. Called him, semi-jokingly, I've called him the Stalin of liberalism, which,
that's great.
Again, kind of a joke, but kind of not.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, yeah, so like, you know, there was definitely that cracking down on the extreme left wing. He also, if I'm not mistaken, cracked down on royalists' uprisings. Was that depicted in the film? Him cracking down on, I believe that was a royalist sort of reactionary uprising, correct, that he put down early in his career?
Yeah, the movie they show it is just kind of him mowing people down mercilessly, yeah. Which is how it was depicted in the right-wing press, but in reality, that was a fight. I mean, he lost 100 men on that day. He was the iron fist that crushed the royalists on that day. Mm.
Sorry, this was the 1795-ish, right? When he opened fire on the crowd using grape shot. Yes?
96. He's opening fire on is mostly made up of National Guard companies who had mutinied, and these sort of armed street gangs that were sort of affiliated with the right wing. So it's, you know, in the movie, it's like, oh, these, you know, it's like old women and crippled guys, and it's so sad. And in reality, right. It would have looked like a battle with guys in uniforms and carrying guns shooting at, you know, it was a, you know, they weren't an organized military force, but it was, you know, imagine if on January 6th, the D.C. National Guard had flipped over and joined the protesters and they'd had to call out the 101st Airborne, you know, to stop them. Mm-hmm. That's basically what happened.
Yeah. Oh, perfect. When I saw it in the movie, I'm like, this is wrong. Because my impression was that it was quite a battle, and like, the use of the cannon and the grape shot didn't happen right away, which to me implied that it was a progression of like rising violence that finally they're like, okay, the only way we can win is opening fire with freaking grape shot on in Paris streets.
Yeah, and which you can still, if you go to that intersection today, you can still see the grape shot the grape shot rounds bounced off the face of a church, and you can still see the little holes in the facade of the church.
Wow, that's awesome. Amazing. And early in his career, like, I believe he wasn't an early Jacobin, right? So like, as a younger man, obviously the revolution made possible people to rise on account of merit. I mean, he was from a noble family, but he was Corsican. He was certainly not in the ruling elite of the ancien regime. It was the revolution that allowed him to rise up. And I believe he was an early sort of supporter of the Jacobins in particular. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, he actually, you know, the in revolutionary France, you have these sort of patron-client relationships between officers and members of the legislature. And Napoleon's big, his one of his first big patrons was Augustin Robespierre, the younger brother of Robespierre, who we all know. So, yeah, he was very much not only on the left, but actually on the not the most radical left, but definitely on the left of the Jacobins, who were the furthest left faction to actually gain power during the revolution. So he there was quite an ideological transformation, which I think, you know, again, it would have been interesting to see some of that on the screen. It's too bad they didn't do that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, truly, because I think that the class dynamics at play weren't really mentioned at all. Like, my impression of that of the French Revolution on screen was that it was very drab, and the people were basically revolting against the king and not a litany of injustices that the system imposed on them.
Well, and they don't really show, you know, this is something that I actually, a gripe I have with a lot of depictions of the revolution, which is they sort of show it as the people or the people or these, you know, this cabal of crafty revolutionaries, depending on your perspective, you know, sort of rising up to challenge the monarchy and destroying it, when what really happened was basically the monarchy collapsed and the revolutionaries sort of stepped into the void left by this, you know, this government that was just, you know, too weak and incompetent to actually address the country's problems. So it's really less, you know, people attacking the state than it is the state sort of just receding and being replaced by something else slowly over the course of years.
Yeah, right.
And that, you know, that's probably, it's kind of not the the sort of orthodox traditional view of how revolutions work. But when you look at them up close, that is generally the model.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. Like, especially like what, I mean, we're going to get to it later, but like, you know, the ideals of the revolution and, you know, one of the good things that you could say, like, internationally anyway, about Napoleon's code that he imposed, and I believe Simon Bolivar was there at his coronation. Wow. Who became the liberator of like South America, and like he imposed his version of, he gave his version of the Napoleonic Code to the people, but it was all driven, that entire independence movement was driven and inspired by all the feelings and drives of the French Revolution itself.
Bolivar has a fascinating relationship with Napoleon. He both admired him. He saw him both as a model and also as a cautionary tale. And you can see in his career him sort of trying to, you know, consciously avoid the pitfalls that that eventually ensnared Napoleon. But yeah, you know, that's, again, that's the, I think, important part of his legacy is things like that. But how cinematic is that? How do you depict that on the screen? I don't know.
Very true. Yeah, no, I wasn't really expecting that from the movie, but like, it's just like, I thought that like, that's necessarily a critique of this film, but just, you know, media in general, whenever they portray a leftist movement, they tend to be drab and dark and dry and hollow. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no passion behind the people's movement.
Yeah. I mean, often it's, you know, this movie, I think, very much did it, where it's, you know, all this, you know, all the political foment that happens around revolutions sort of gets simplified and flattened and, becomes just sort of anger. You know, people got so angry that right. They got angry enough to kill the king. And, you know, that's just, you know, again, you know, you look at it up close and it's just, there's so much more going on, and there's, you know, lots of kind of structural political things that you know, no one has control over and are not subject to anyone's, you know, emotions. And that's really where the action is, you know, from like a historian's, a scholar's perspective, is in these factors that are so far outside of, you know, individual people's feelings and emotions. that really are the driving forces behind these things, rather than, you know, just sort of, you know, there's a lot of that kind of fear of the rabble, which mm-hmm. I think you get in this movie and in a lot of media about the French Revolution and revolutions in general, that just kind of there's this mass, the rabble, and when they get mad enough, bad things happen.
Yeah. That's really interesting, too, because something that happened in my personal life that aligned with my watching of this film and all the research around it, of course, and my ongoing interest in that history is, like, I'm taking a high-level college course for my master's degree currently on – it was just an entire course. It's wrapping up next week on just the American Revolutionary Era. Of course, France was, you know, a huge ally of the U.S. Without French assistance, the U.S. very well could have lost that war to the Brits. Now, of course, the American Revolution is in many ways much more conservative than the French Revolution. The American Revolution was progressive in the sense that it formalized the break from constitutional monarchism to full-on republicanism. But the founding fathers, quote unquote, they were very conservative people. They were very concerned with the rabble, with the mob. The construction of the Constitution and the Constitutional Convention was really in some ways driven by this sort of fear of, like, you know, this balancing act of, you know, we want to create this republic and that's going to involve democracy, but we want to limit the scope of that democracy. Before the Constitutional Convention in the U.S., there was the period of time under which the loosely structured states were under the Articles of Confederation, right? Much less federalist, much less nationalizing government, much more control to the states. And it was actually Shay's Rebellion, this sort of farmer uprising from the lower classes, that really spooked the founding fathers and the elite in the new American country, and really shifted away from the Articles of Confederation and necessitated the construction of a more powerful national federalist state that was sort of codified in the Constitution and the Constitutional Convention. So these class politics are always at play. Now, the French Revolution, in comparison, was also, of course, a bourgeois revolution, also broke away from the constraints of monarchism and feudalism as this historical event. But in the early days, especially under Jacobin leadership, it was much more radical, much more left-wing than the American Revolution. And, of course, that resulted in the Thermidorian reaction and then eventually, you know, the crowning of Napoleon as emperor, which sort of ended that republican experiment for a time. The U.S. never had a Napoleonic-like figure, never had a regression like that. And at the end of Napoleon's life, he said famously, this might be another apocryphal quote, and you can correct me, but he said they wanted me to be another Washington, meaning, you know, Washington has this reputation of, like, in this dignified way, he refused to go beyond his term limits. He, you know, confined himself to leaving and going back to Mount Vernon and allowing the next election to take place when the stature of Washington was so big and he had so much popular support that if he wanted to pull a move like Napoleon pulled, he could have. Credibly, there was an option for him to do that, and he didn't want to do that. So that Napoleon saying they wanted me to be a Washington, I always found very interesting. So there's this left-wing, egalitarian, progressive element to the French Revolution that the U.S. Revolution didn't really have. But in other ways, there was this counter-revolutionary side that we've talked about. But there's also this big question of Haiti, right? You have the American Revolution, pretty conservative in relation to the French Revolution. Then you have the Haitian Revolution, which is in some ways more revolutionary, more extreme than either of those two revolutions. And some of the worst elements of Napoleon came out in relation to Haiti, right? The reintroduction of slavery after the Code Napoleon had abolished slavery. Can you talk about Napoleon and his relationship with Haiti and why we can on, as people on the left today, we can call his relationship with Haiti and his actions toward Haiti on the counter-revolutionary and very conservative side of his rule?
Yeah, so that's I would point to Haiti as the you know, he's got many black marks on his record, but that I would say is the ugliest one. Mm-hmm. It should be said that he had no direct control over his troops in Haiti, so you know, they were by far the most notorious, you know, of the the black deeds of the French army in this period, that is, Haiti is by far the worst. I mean, they really conducted themselves in a, I mean, not quite genocidal, but certainly bordering on genocidal level. And, you know, it's, you see when in the early phase of Napoleon's rule, where he's trying to sort of figure out where the line is on his compromises with the old order, the counter-revolutionaries, because he's trying to, you know, his first big task is ending the civil conflict that had torn France apart since the radical phase of the revolution, mm-hmm. and trying to sort of offer concessions to the old order, to the conservatives, whatever you want to call them, to get them back on board, and sort of, you know, I talked about that, that idea of turning the page on the revolution. And so he's trying to find the line, how to accomplish that, how to turn that page. And that involves concessions. And, you know, all through the history of colonialism, the colonies have played that role for European powers as a space outside the politics on the mainland, where you can sort of square the circle of your political problems at home. So it's a, from his perspective, it's a sort of consequence-free concession to the conservatives. You know, it's not going to reinstating slavery in the colonies, not only in Haiti, by the way, all over the French colonies, they brought back slavery. And, you know, the idea is, you know, hey, this is something we can offer the conservatives that will make them very happy. The planter lobby was extremely powerful and extremely influential within the conservative movement. And it's not going to have an effect on domestic French politics. You know, it's not going to have any impact whatsoever on my domestic program. I can just offer this bone to the old order. And so, you know, Napoleon as a youth had been an abolitionist. So that's, to me, the really kind of disturbing thing about this, is that he's not some ignorant racist. He is a person who's been around black people in his life and worked with them in a positive way, who held anti-slavery beliefs, but he made the calculation that this was something politically he had to do. And so he did it. And that is fascinating and kind of chilling to imagine the psychology behind a decision like that, yeah. that you're going to put people in chains who you know deep down don't deserve it. And the results are pretty terrifying as well.
I think it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the Italian campaign and, you know, like how it gives us such insight into him, because, like, you know, not only did he have that kind of, you know, hands-on troop with the troops atmosphere and keeping them happy, his campaign in Italy was, and I know everyone always compares him to Caesar or Hannibal or Alexander the Great, but to me, Napoleon revealed himself as like Lucius Cornelius Sulla, like in his conduct in the Italian campaign, you know, the looting to, he's Sulla in Greece, I should say. He's looting, mass rape, mass plunder, to pay his troops, these revolutionary troops who haven't been paid in God knows how long, and at the same time repopulating the treasury, and is very willing to embrace every element, but particularly the most conservative when it's convenient to him. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
absolutely. And to me, that's the really interesting, you know, people talk about you know, what a megalomaniac he was and what a villain he was. And to me, I think people are sort of missing, you know, in a sense, they're missing what's really chilling about it, which is that he's not just slaking his bloodlust. He doesn't really have bloodlust. He actually is horrified by battlefield casualties. He's a person who, because he sees himself as one of the great men of history, he you know, was a reader of, as you called him, a history nerd earlier in the episode. It's absolutely true. He was. And he very much understood and believed that part of being a great man of history was being able to mete out violence when it was called for, being able to be cruel when it was called for, being able to be heartless when it was called for. And he, you know, to him, that was as much a part of the job as the nice stuff. And he saw it as his duty to approach that part of the job unflinchingly and to not think twice and just do it. And so you do have a person who, again, and it's not, he doesn't love killing people. It's in a way weirder than that. He just is kind of willing to do it because that's his role. And
so in Greece, man, I'm telling you,
it's chilling when you look at it up close. But, you know, on a certain level, I mean, everyone in that era who's a political actor is making decisions like that. So he's not really wrong. It's just sort of no one else is doing it on that scale, and no one else is doing it kind of with their eyes open like that. Hmm. And it's a little bit unnerving.
For sure.
Take a close look at it.
That's a great point, yeah. Now, just to one more final point on this, the Haitian chapter is, I believe it's in 1802 in which Napoleon reintroduces slavery in the French colonies. 1804 is the pinnacle of the Haitian Revolution that ultimately succeeds. Do you know anything about Napoleon's reaction to the success of the Haitian Revolution and the sort of kicking out of the French at that point?
Well, there's a famous, supposedly when he was informed of, you know, that the expedition had surrendered and that it was really, you know, well and truly over. Supposedly he said, damned coffee, damned sugar, damned colonies. Hmm. So I think, you know, this was just, you know, again, he's not a sentimental person. He's, you know, this is just a, you know, well, that particular policy initiative has failed. That's a shame. Hmm. You know, he's not, he occasionally gets angry, but he's not really a emotional person. So he, you know, he took it in stride, as ugly and horrific as it was.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff.
Very interesting, yeah.
Yeah. So I want to sort of zoom in towards the end of the conversation here, and I want to talk a bit about his eventual exile. There were two attempts, right? The first exile was in Elba, a small island in the Mediterranean. The second exile was in St. Helena, this far-flung island in between South America and Africa where Napoleon ultimately died. You know, one of the things that fascinated me about Napoleon when I first got into his story was the fact that this guy was such a menace in Europe that all of Europe had to basically team up and kick his ass out and jail him on this small island 1,000 miles away from the mainland so he could never return. And you had British ships patrolling the island, making sure Napoleon never gets off. It's like just a fascinating story of how one man was such a menace that he had to be completely exiled to this island. So I'm just wondering, leaving this question as wide open as I can, if both of you can kind of give your thoughts and analysis on his exile and eventual death at the relatively young age, I believe, of like 51 years old.
Sure. Yo, I want to say, like, his exile to Elba is kind of fascinating in that, like, you know, the British tabloids, newspapers, like, you know, I famous quotation headline, I hope he has enough Elba room. But on Elba, he wasn't like a prisoner. He ruled it, yeah, and brought that like island, you know, being an original island boy himself.
Because I'm an island boy, and I've been trying to make, oh, I'm an island boy.
Like, evolved its economy and took, like, a severe interest in it. Whereas, like, you know, his subsequent exile to St. Helena was quite literally a prison sentence. You know, like, they were both, like, kind of vastly different.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was this idea among the European nobility that sort of once you've been accepted as, you know, recognized as a legitimate monarchical ruler, that is inalienable. And, you know, maybe we can, you know, shuffle around exactly how many territories you rule over. But, you know, really, you know, monarchs should not be in the business of deposing other monarchs. You know, understandably, that is not a precedent no one wanted set.
Mm-hmm. Right. Divine right.
Right. Yeah. The they all have whatever their conflicts, every person in Europe with a crown has a shared interest in this idea that, you know, toppling someone from power is just not done. There need to be rules to these conflicts we have. Mm-hmm. And so they were, I think, a bit naive in thinking that they could, you know, maintain this precedent with Napoleon, that he, you know, that he would just sort of retire and, you know, busy himself with, you know, setting the tariffs on this little tiny island and, you know, building a university for them and stuff like that. And, you know, you look at the diplomacy of the era and you can understand why they thought that was a good idea. But in retrospect, you know, something like the 100 days when he came back was bound to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I completely agree with that. It had to happen given the way everything was set up before the first exile. Yeah.
In a way, I mean, the way Napoleon had lived his life, I mean, it was not only set up for that, like politically and geopolitically. I mean, his character, he did not stop for anything. It's the guy, you know, from his teenage years, did everything full bore, 110%, you know, pushing until someone stops you was kind of his attitude to basically everything. Someone like that does not just, you know, take a rest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Someone like that does not retire. You know, he was going to be pushing and pushing and pushing until they physically stopped him, which eventually they were forced to do.
Yeah, totally. I wanted you guys' opinion on this. Like, I think that bringing it back to the movie, I think that Villeneuve's Dune gave us the kind of perfect modern formula for an epic film, and I would have loved to see Scott use this approach. You know, like you do an all out roll of the dice on Dune, Rise of the Twink. And it's well received, and now we get Dune 2, Revenge of the Twink. You know what I mean? You split it up into two kind of grand epics. Because especially when you're dealing with something as a topic as vast as this, I feel like that kind of approach, you know, taking a risk by just doing, I don't know, the Italian campaign in Egypt and, you know, everything that was going on in between would have been, in my opinion, more compelling. What do you guys think about that kind of approach to historical filmmaking, you know, given that we've all kind of, you know, given Hollywood a lot of credit and leeway in the sense that it's very hard to make historical movies.
Yeah, I think, you know, a very good model is the movie Lincoln, which, you know, mm-hmm. does not start with Lincoln being born in a log cabin. It starts with him already president and is about a pretty discreet period of time. You know, really, it's not really so much a Lincoln biopic as it is a film about the passage of the Reconstruction Amendments and the end of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Sort of centered on Lincoln, but not really a biopic. And I think that would have been an interesting approach to take with this, just because the story is so big. I also saw someone joked on Twitter that they should have done a Letters from Iwo Jima / Flags of Our Fathers type deal, where they could have done one movie that was depicting Napoleon's real dark side, you know, showing him as this kind of heartless, evil conqueror, and then done another movie that showed him as sort of, you know, the avatar of the Enlightenment, destroying the old order, freeing Europe from feudalism, you know, the positive side of him. Mm-hmm. That would have been an interesting approach, too. I would have loved to see something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, for my two cents on that, what I would have loved, and I told this to my wife right after the film, is, I don't know if people are familiar, but in 2008, there was this HBO drama called John Adams, where they, you know, do sort of immersed in the time, and you do like 8 episodes or 10 episodes sort of going through all of that history instead of trying to fit it into to 2 hours. And I think like a HBO level drama series with a big budget. I mean, they did the old series in like 2004, Rome, which was another example of this historical epic where they, you know, sort of cover,
shout out to Rome.
Yeah, cover huge periods of time. And with a figure like Napoleon and a history like the Napoleonic Age, I feel like movies are cool. They're awesome. They're fun. But I would have loved to see like an actual drama television series really going through where you could spend much more time delving into his character. You could spend much more time on the history involved. And that would have, I think it would have lent itself to more, to a lot of the stuff that you and I would have liked to have seen from this film, but the limitations of film as such, sort of require these sort of annotated versions, you know, these quick jumps through history, this hyper fast pace that never slows down. And to be able to have a drama series that you could really take your time with it, even with a figure like Joaquin Phoenix playing Napoleon, but allowing Joaquin to explore different aspects of Napoleon, I think that would have been like the best way to do this. But that's just sort of my takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, I agree.
I'm biased. I've got 100 hours under my belt. I'm only halfway through the story, so obviously, yeah, I agree that a longer format is better.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
All right. Well, I think that about takes the cake for this episode. I really appreciate you guys coming on. I want to give you both one last chance to give maybe a final take on the film, a final take on the man, and then we can get into recommendations and let people know where they can find you. Do you guys have any final thoughts on this film and this history?
Ever, go ahead, brother.
I already said this on Chapo, but I'll say it again. The body count that they show at the end should have been all the women Napoleon slept with, not the faculties from his battles.
Hear, hear. Yeah, to me, it's like beware false populists. Mm. The thing about the left is whether people realize it or not, like it represents 90% of the population, and it's so easy for us to turn on each other once the 1 or 10% is vanquished. So, like to me, it's like any revolutionary project needs a few broad goals like housing, food, education in the context of a representative government, and anyone who veers off that is bound to be a demagogue.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. All right, Hegel called him history on horseback, and that's why Napoleon continues to fascinate us to this day, and the world that we live in today is in many ways a product of not just Napoleon, of course, but of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic era. So fascinating person, fascinating history. Thank you so much, Everett and Arjun, for coming on the show, for doing this collaboration. Again, you have Age of Napoleon, Everett's show. I can't recommend it enough. Deep into History, Arjun's show. Can't recommend that enough. As a final question to wrap up this conversation, do you have any other recommendations for those who would want to learn more about any of this history? And then can you please let listeners know where they can find you and your work online?
So if you know how to find this podcast, you can find my podcast as well. Mm-hmm. It's called The Age of Napoleon. It's, you know, look it up wherever you found this and you'll find it there.
Wonderful. Arjun?
Awesome. Yeah, like I just want to reiterate what Brett said. Like, I recommend everyone listen to Age of Napoleon and Rev Left Radio, of course. Especially, you did some amazing episodes about the history of the French Revolution, which I love. As far as books go, I'll go back to where I started with Napoleon. So there's a book called The Letters of Napoleon to Josephine by Diana Reed Haig. I believe that book is out of print, so I'll be posting links to it on social media. You can follow me at Deep in History on every social media platform. I'm not on Facebook because, like, fuck that, but everything else. And yeah, my show is available on every podcast platform. And, you know, it's such an honor to talk with you guys. I had the best time. You guys rock.
Absolutely. I share that sentiment. Thank you both so
much. Thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun talking to you.
Absolutely. All right. Have a good one, guys.
execution on Hitler's tongue. The next century crashed hard with a loud sound like a starting gun. It's a race for acquisition, and to make more things that glow. I got a knack for dodging bullets and flying zeros. So I act like I am rich, try and make it my whole look, 'cause poor people don't exist when times are good. Mozart's foster parents put cigarettes out in his ears. When he got old enough to stutter, he said, "I don't listen, but I can hear." The eloquence of traffic, yeah, the mill pond sad lament. It's a requiem of moments. I keep living through them, but where's the monster in the closet? I can't find the hangman inside his hood. I guess evil don't exist when times are good. Dr. Oppenheimer winced. We felt the broken piece of his pacemaker. Unbuttoned his shirt on a subway platform, clutching his chest while his vision blurred. He saw the bane of his creation, the destroyer of the world. Yeah, truth can lead to solace or a lifelong bender. It's like wading through a wasteland where a town you loved once stood. You just cry each time you think of when times were good. Dressed him in a giant hat and funny platform shoes, saying anyone can be a hero, you just gotta force people to look up to you. So when you're talking on a hotline to a suicidal soul, don't let your voice sound like hot coffee, more like a scented pillow. And strive for understanding over being understood. Just don't let yourself forget when the times get good.